Senator Lawton Childs, January 30th, 1974.
Well, perhaps, although,
the Democratic Party,
although
new face,
5% of the people recognized my name when I started running for the United States Senate, so even though I'd spent 12 years in the state legislature, I can't say that I built that much of a statewide image.
No, but you did have a record.
Yeah, right. I did have that, and I think that 5% were very helpful to me when I ran because, generally speaking, it was positive and it was good, and it was the nucleus, I guess, or the basis from where we went from there. But it wasn't like we had any great visibility.
But if you look back over this period since 1948, what are the major changes in Florida politics?
Oh, tremendous changes, I think, in all kind of different ways. Let's deal with race first. In 1948, race was still a very, very strong, probably the strongest thing. If you were wrong on the race thing, you were dead. And you had to walk into the back door of the black church if you were seeking their votes, and you were almost afraid to seek them. And then that started to change. And that change has been complete now. And I think the 1970 election, probably was when we brought it about the complete change in Florida, in that the governor openly courted black votes, as I did. We said we were doing it. We appeared, with blacks. And so because Florida had changed, I guess you might say we were able to do that, or that change had occurred over a period of years. It didn't occur overnight. It changed from 48 and kept changing on the thing. But now, while race is still there, to say it isn't there, and the people use perhaps other ways, but now it does become a candidate must seek the black vote now, and he must acknowledge that he's seeking the black vote. So now you have all candidates saying we are seeking the black vote. So it differs completely from the way it used to be a negative thing. Now it would hurt you if you tried to say as a candidate that you weren't seeking them, or if you made some derogatory remark. So I think that's very good, because nationally, this really caused a schizophrenia with the Southern politician, and it kept him where he could be kind of be right on all issues, but he had to turn around on the race thing. And so I think it kept him from being a whole person or from just ringing true all the way through. So I really think now that the South is ready to furnish national leadership. And I think that because of problems that we've had in race and other things, we're perhaps better equipped to furnish it. And I think that's why in 70, I think there were an awful lot of new, fresh faces. And Bumpers of Arkansas and Carter and Bennett Johnson of Louisiana, Waller, all of these, Askew, all of these people are sort of a new breed of cats, I think, in that they're all basically speaking to the issues. They're not trying to appeal to prejudice, and they're trying to deal with solving of problems. And I think that's healthy in going to build a core of leadership from the South that will have to be recognized nationally, because they have sort of come through the fire and come out on the other side. Now let's just look at some of the other changes. When I went to the legislature in 1958, we were controlled by the so-called pork chop group. In effect, it was 17% of the people controlled both houses of the legislature, so really legislators represented pine trees more than they did people. Neither house was apportioned according to even the Florida Constitution, and with the change of the apportionment decisions, one man, one vote, and that brought about a drastic change. It broke sort of the stranglehold of the status quo, which heretofore existed, where the vested interest in the lobbyists just exerted almost total control. They could tell you how many votes any particular bill was going to get.
Who were the vested interests in Florida at that time?
Well, I'd say that
really controlled the
legislature. A lot of them were some of the largest landowners, be timber, phosphate, those kind of interest that would be part of them. Part of it was anybody that really was for the status quo, because it was the kind of legislature that you could defeat most things. You couldn't pass a lot of legislation, but you could defeat any legislation. So it wouldn't necessarily have to be the largest or richest person. It could just be a group that wanted to keep the status quo. That turned out to kind of be the, you know, the vested interest, because it was easier to block things. It was very easy to block. It was very difficult to pass something. Also, the legislature really was a rubber stamp during that time. The cabinet of Florida, which was an elected cabinet, and always sort of a unique branch according to most state governments, but the cabinet served as sort of a super legislature. The legislature met 60 days every other year, and the main thing they did at the time they met was to sign a check, and the check was the appropriations for the next 2 years. The cabinet had emergency powers, so that with 5 out of the 7 votes, they could start new buildings, they could change money from one program to another, they could take all kind of effects, and which they routinely did. Every day on their agenda, or every week when they'd meet, would be these things that would always get 5 out of 7 votes, and so they really ran the state. And so the legislature had surrendered its power.
Could they transfer money from agency to agency as well as within an agency?
Primarily, it would be within an agency, but they then had some emergency powers. Or another thing they would do, especially with buildings, almost every new building during the time, the first 5 or 6 years I was in the legislature, and the previous years behind that, was done through revenue certificates. So what they would do is they had the authority to start renting a building. They'd say, we're going to rent the building. The rent will serve as the financing for the revenue certificates, so they would start the building. So most of the major court buildings, most of the major capitol buildings, most of the Florida Citrus Commission, all of those buildings were started by the cabinet. So they could, again, start programs, and then they'd use some sort of a temporary funding or shifting, and then the legislature would just come in and rubber stamp the program. But they were the initiators of almost all of the programs of legislation that we went into. All of that, then the legislature had what was called a legislative council. The council was to be the legislature in the interim period of time. It had study committees. None of those committees were like your standing committees, because the standing committees were only created for 1 year. They automatically disbanded. It had to take new chairmen automatically. They had no carryover, and you had on the legislative council, once you were on the council, you stayed unless you lost office. So you had a different, completely different number of people on the council. It didn't even represent the leadership of your legislature. And they, in turn, sort of were the super legislature. And they had the right to obligate the legislature for all kind of matters in the interim. And so they would work with the cabinet or the governor at the time. And as I say, they were not representative of the leadership of the legislature. So then the other thing, of course, is the legislature had no staff, no offices. We used to meet on the floor when I started. Your secretary would sit by you on the floor and try to answer mail. And we had absolutely no staff. The Appropriations Committee would borrow people from the executive branches to use them in overseeing and looking at the executive branch's budget. So if you want to look at the Department of Agriculture's budget, you had a borrowed man from the Department of Agriculture that you used to look at their budget, because you had nobody else, no permanent kind of staff. all of this, again, we changed in the legislative reorganization. And then and further than that, we adopted the new constitution, which gave home rule really back to the counties, where before local bills had to be passed on everything. If you wanted to set up a dog pound, if you wanted to change boundaries, if you wanted to do anything in your county or your city, you had to come to the legislature and pass a local bill, which meant that was where the legislator's powers were not in control of state government, really, but in control of local government, where they set sort of like feudal barons over their county, and the county commissioners and city commissioners had to pay homage to you because you set their salaries and you had to really pass anything that they wanted. And so that was more what we were. We were super county commissioners than we were state legislators. So in the reorganization, we kind of changed that and set the proper function for it. The reorganization of the executive branch streamlined the procedure and really gave the governor, made the governor the titular head, even though the cabinet still retains some powers in certain areas that the was a compromise, really, between those who wanted the strong governor and to really denude the cabinet completely and those who wanted to place a check on the governor with the cabinet. And the compromise has proved to be pretty workable, but it certainly strengthened the governor and gave him the ability to really lead.
Now, you were very active in legislative reform in Florida.
Yeah.
I understand it's not your interest in the Congress.
Right.
Isn't it a little bit ironic that a Southern senator be involved in the sense of, the reform of congressional procedures when the Congress, for all practical purposes, controlled this chairmanship by many people in the South?
Well, that's
how do your colleagues feel about that?
Well, I see the cleavage now. As far as I know, there is no Southern Caucus that's meeting. When I first came up here, I think they held some meetings of the Southern Conference Caucus. I was invited to one, and wasn't invited. I didn't go to any more, and I don't get invited anymore. But I don't think there is a such thing as a Southern Caucus. I think now we're, you know, and the vestiges of that, or the reason for that, of course, was the trying to block civil rights legislation. I don't think you're going to find any of the new members from the South that are elected that want to participate in, you know, in blocking that. Most of the legislation's on the books now, but it's interesting to see that the filibuster even is turning around and is not being used by the people trying to block civil rights legislation. If anything, it's at times being used effectively by the other side. But I think what you're seeing now is the vestiges of where the Southern group had control of chairmanships. But even that's changing every day. And I see a cleavage now more in the Senate on the basis of not just age, almost on basis, if there was any basis, on basis of time elected to the Senate. Than I do on area, than I do on party, even. We had a started meeting with a group of freshmen in the 1970 class, primarily concerned with housekeeping functions to start with. We couldn't get the office changes. Every one of us were getting kicked out of the office of the old senator that we replaced, and we knew that. But when? It ran over a year, you know, almost, and we couldn't get, and we got moved down from one office as you'd get bumped or something, you'd get moved. So we found people were taking up to 3 weeks or a month to make their decision between what office they wanted. And so things like that, and the fact that there was a very little difference, about $50,000 difference between the budget of the senator from Alaska and the budget of the senator from California, regardless of the tremendous caseload and mail and everything else. So we started addressing ourselves to those kind of things, how to allow the larger states to have larger budgets and handle their work, how to have proper office space, how to get some of these housekeeping things together. And that was a bipartisan group. It was just all of the freshmen. Then we broadened that group and took in the 72 freshmen. Then the 68 group decided they really wanted to join us, and so we've had meetings in which we represent some 40-something senators, you know, or fall within kind of that general area, and we find that our thinking is alike. While we try not to get into philosophical measures, in most of the reform areas, we think alike in opening up of meetings.
Is that a function of recent elections, or is that a function of the kind of people that are coming?
I think it's a function of the kind of people that are coming, and I see it very much in the people that are coming up from the South. I think it's a function that many of them have either served in state government or served in the Congress or have been under this old kind of, again, status quo, don't change anything. You know, you'll earn your spurs in 10 or 12 years and stick around till that time.
Do you see that among both new Republican and Democratic?
Yes, yes, very much so. I find that on some questions I might differ a lot with Brock of Tennessee. On most of the reform measures, for example, we'll think exactly alike on most of those measures. And he's performing a role of leadership in that area and trying to and reform of committees, reform of budgets, reform of opening up all this kind of thing. I see it very definitely.
But it doesn't extend from procedural matters to really substantive matters.
Well, it does where those, it's hard to draw the line in a reform area where it's almost procedural or substantive because it crosses into that. And in many of those, it does kind of fall into there too. Again, I think one of the healthy things about some of the people coming up from the South is that, generally speaking, or some of the Southern leadership that I'm seeing, it is not triggered as much to feeling they got to have 100% ACU reading as an ADA reading. And too many of the Senate, as I see them, almost feel like they got to wear one hat or the other. And so they tend to vote knee-jerk on issues based on how that's going to place them. In those areas. And I tend to see a lot of the Southerners that feel like they can take issue by issue, the new ones that are coming up, and vote convictions on those issues. So if anything, it's more of a populist kind of trend or thing. If you look at Hollings of South Carolina, if you look at Spong's voting record, and I thought you'd think he was a great senator. He got caught in this in the Goldwater thing, but Benson of Texas, Nunn, myself, Huddleston, Johnson, all those, and look at the voting records. What I found when I came up here, and I kind of see it happening in these other people too, is a lot of times people were coming to me and say, "We can't understand your vote on such and such." I said, "Why not?" "Well, because a week ago you voted the other way. You voted on this." And they felt like, you just have to be like sticking a pin in a butterfly. You're supposed to stand on one track or one course, and you're never supposed to be able to find out anything different. Well, I just don't think that we're triggered that way. I don't feel that way myself, that I have to vote one way because I voted the other way.
Well, the common perception was because race was the one thing that united, at least oppressed everybody in that sense.
Yeah.
You're saying that since that's been removed, you now have more freedom to be responsive to other kinds of constituencies.
And I think we feel that freedom and are exercising it at a wider degree than the guy up north is. And then the guy, in extent in the West, he's still kind of locked in somewhere in many instances.
You mean regionally?
Yes, or if not regionally locked in, that he's got to be a conservative and wear the conservative hat all the time, or he's locked in as a liberal and has to wear the liberal hat all the time. In a time in which the issues that made up liberal or conservative are changing, I see guys that agonize as to whether they think this vote is going to be considered by ADA as being liberal or not, almost, and they're trying to outguess because they either want to fit in that group or they want to make sure they don't get in that group. And so they agonize.
But they're in the older generation of congressmen and senators.
Generally speaking, they are, yeah. Right. But I see more of the Southerners that have been coming in that seem to feel freer, that are voting freer.
You see the old conservative coalition, as it frequently was referred to, as dying completely. diminishing?
Well, I don't say dying completely. I think it depends on probably still some areas that you find Democrats of a conservative persuasion vote with Republicans. I think it's not the lockstep thing that it was before, and it's harder to define the issues.
The Democrats from the South who were elected 1966 on, has anyone done it? Do you know whether or not a majority of them are voting a majority of the time with the Democratic majority as a whole?
I don't know. You could look at a printout that's done by how the and find that out. That information would be pretty easily discernible from a printout. Shows what the president's position was, and how the majority of the Republican was, and how the majority.
Well, there has been a change in the House of Representatives. That is, more Democrats from the South now vote with the Democrats rather than the Republicans in the last 2 years.
Yeah. I think that change would...
Another thing we've found is that...
I know it would be true from 66 on, that more Democrats from the South would be voting with the Democrats than with the Republicans.
Another change we found among the younger Democrats in the House and in the Senate is that they're more oriented towards their district. That is, they're more responsive, and they tend to communicate more with the people in their district than some of the older members. At least they see it this way. Is that true of the senators as well?
Well, it's true of me. I don't, I think it is. Yeah, I see most of the ones that I know that they're going back all the time, especially the ones who just elected. Most of us got elected more from a populist base, or more sort of a people thing. More of us were long shots.
Of you were not organization candidates.
That's what I mean. And so there, my constituency, yeah, that's all I can really speak for intelligently, my constituency is not based on any kind of organization. I can't call somebody in 10 towns and be, giving the word, so to speak, back to the folks. I didn't have organizations in most towns. I don't know the people that were working for me. I find out every day because they were just somebody I waved at on the street or I ran into, that knew that I was out there walking or something. So it's a completely different kind of constituency. And I find when I want to go back and see my people, I go like 2 weeks from now, I'm going back and walking a parade at the Gasparilla, the Tampa Fair. That's where I'm going to see my people, or where they're going to see me, because I don't know any other way to try to see them. I'll go back and try to get on the tube when I can.
But isn't that a fundamental change in Florida politics, too, the way you campaign?
Yeah.
The last 10 or 15
years? Yeah.
How did the working guy originate?
Well, I guess I had, in 58, when I ran for the state legislature, I knocked on doors. My wife went down one side of the street, and I went down the other. Ran against a guy that held office for 10 years, and so he had all the committee structure and the money, and so we just went out and spent 3 months knocking on doors and tried to go see everybody in the county. And from that, I never had another serious race, and everybody would always say, that's the guy that knocks on doors. And when I started running for the U.S. Senate, when I went around my county first to try to get support there, everybody kept mentioning, we remember you came to our house, or why don't you do something like that, or something. And so then I was going to run in May, and the former governor, who I had been his floor leader, Ferris Bryant, decided to get in the race when they changed the primary to September. When he did that, it cut off all of the sort of, you might say, any kind of organizational support, because we didn't have party, we had personality group cults. We had the Hayden Burns group and the Ferris Bryant group and the Leroy Collins group and everyone that sort of had been in office. His so-called people were the kind of the groups. So I lost all the Ferris Bryant group and was left with nothing. And so the idea was, could you transfer this knocking on doors? Would it transfer if you walked across the road? And so that's where the sort of the idea came from, and the necessity was that I didn't have any way of getting any money or any kind of support other than that, and I decided this was my time to run. I was either going to run in or get out of state government.
In the legislature, you and the governor asked you to serve together.
Right.
Did you work together closely on the various reform measures that took place?
Yeah, generally speaking, we were in the sort of, we were in the we went to the legislature at the same time. I was 8 years in the House, and he was 4 in the House, and then he went to the Senate, and I was 8 in the House, and then I went to the Senate. So we were always contemporaries, and generally speaking, we both went to the Eagleton school, I think one different year, and that sparked us, you know, in going forward. So generally, we were basically for the same things and for trying to, you know, to change the process and strengthen it and cause the lobbyists to register and pass a conflicts of interest bill and kind of things like that. We, you know, we were always...
Were your campaigns linked at all in 1970?
Were they what?
Were they linked in any way?
People linked them. They were not actually linked, but people linked them a lot because we were both sort of the two long shots in the race. And when it happened that we both came up and won the primary, or got in the second primary, then people started making a link. And there were quite a few young people in all that were in both campaigns because, you know, we were both kind of the long shots and both not doing things the usual way. And so that kind of link was made. We never put our campaigns together, never tried to. We both tried very hard to run our own race. We recognized that we sort of both mutually got some benefit out of the other one being there, but we tried very hard not to put it together. During the after the primaries were over, and we again both had people that were in the other camp, you know, might say, but after the primary was over, in the general election, we did start kind of running together in some places. We still ran separate campaigns, but we started talking about each other, and we started talking about the Republicans at that time. The president was coming down and holding their hands up and bringing all these people down, and so we said there's a D.C. current going on, and that's coming from out of the state, and we've got an AC current, and that's Askew and Childs, and so we tried to make what we could out of that sort of thing.
So that's a lot of quorum that's begun over there.
Okay.
Can I ask you about a theory about some of the southern states, which is essentially sure. This, that after so many years of Democratic rule in state administrations, every state reaches a point where they want to reform. So what they do is they put the Democrats out and put a Republican in, like Winthrop Rockefeller, like Kirk and so on. But after 3 or 4 years, the party has a chance to cleanse itself or reform itself, put the new leadership in, and then they go back to the Democratic rule.
Well, I think Florida is, maybe that applies. I don't know that I've studied this much that way. But what I saw in Florida happen is that Florida has, and I think happened in a lot of other places too, from the time of the Civil War to the time of, the late 50s, really to the 60s, we had a no-party situation. Really, you might say Eisenhower kind of almost came along. It was a no-party situation. Have they got the quorum? How long have you been on?
Well, I just came on about 3 or 4 months ago.
They got it that quick, or they just called it off?
I'll check.
They might find out, because I want to go over there and register myself anyway if they got it. In that sort of no-party situation, then you got these personality cults that grew up. And the party had no influence. Everybody ran under the Democratic umbrella, but you might as well have not called it Democratic, you know, other than it was just the history was there. And that, you know, when Kirk got in, we got a situation in which sort of the liberals and the conservatives of the Democratic Party got into a fight. And High was elected from Miami, who was considered to be a liberal because he came from Miami. And then Burns, who was the then governor, was defeated by High in the primary, for he had a sort of a 2-year term because everybody thought that he wasn't honest. Then he turned around and went to the Republicans, to Kirk. He just went out to defeat High, and his people switched around and or sat on their hands, and that elected Kirk. So maybe it's part of what you say, but part of it is the fact that we had a no-party situation. I think for the first time we're trying to build a Democratic Party in Florida. We have a viable Republican Party, well-organized, well-disciplined, or it was until they had a little prosperity. In my election, they tore each other up, you know, with the Kramer Kirk fight and the Carswell, all of that situation. They hit the fan, but still, they've got a better party structure, better organized than we've had, because our old party vestiges were just like an old soldier group. They went to meetings and fought. They didn't know. They never knocked on a door. They never passed out a piece of literature. They never solicited a vote. They just, it was just a thing that you put on your uniform, went out and fought among each other.
But neither you or Eskew were identified with any of those personality factions.
No. That's
so,
right.
Since you represent a new aspect. Or
that's right. That's right. And we are now, with John Moyle in Florida, trying to build a Democratic Party. I can't tell you how much success we've had at it, but because it's hard to cut the old away on a thing, but we're working at it.
Both started.
George Patton and Senator Child's office. The first thing I would do would be to contact Charlie Kennedy in Lakeland. It's area 813, the number 688-6681. Charlie managed the senator's campaign when he ran and has as good a grasp of all the people that you ought to talk to get a feel for that sort of thing. He is in the Lakeland office.
Okay. Who is the Democratic Party chairman?
John Moyle. He mentioned that.
Right. He is located where?
He is a lawyer, and his firm is in West Palm Beach, but he also has an office in Tallahassee as the state Democratic Party chairman.
Is he usually there?
Well, you can either find
him. There
Charlie will have his number for you, but you can either find him in Tallahassee or in West Palm Beach, one of the two. It's Moyle, John Moyle.